docket. I guess the word got out pretty quickly that if you came here early, your case might be heard early, so we appreciate those who did come in. Let me remind everybody on the merit cases, if you could make sure that Mr. Shorter here gets your sign-in sheet so that we can have it for record-keeping purposes, it would be appreciated. Also on the writ cases, if you could simply identify yourself for us, that would be helpful also. All right, first case we'll take is Lamb versus Lamb.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Is this, yes. Mrs. Lamb?
Yes, sir, this is
Eve. If you could have her, is this Mrs. Lamb?
Yes, sir.
If you could have her take a seat on the first row.
Yes, sir.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you, ma'am, for being here today. So if you could scoot over by the mic, that would help us out. Thank you. You may begin when ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. This involves an appeal regarding my client's interest in her former husband's military retired pay. The parties were married back in October of 1993. Separated in May of 2005. Their marriage was a little over 11 years. Throughout the marriage, Mr. Lamb was employed by the United States Army. He was a singer in the United States Army Band. At the time of the parties had two settlement agreements. One was a partial settlement agreement executed on March 9 of 2006. That agreement, I think, is relevant because there's significant consideration given by my client. She agreed to repay a $45,000 loan to her father, which he made to the parties for the purchase of their first house. The second settlement agreement was July 11, 2006. In that agreement, there was a mutual waiver of spousal support, and there was also an agreement that she would receive 50% of the marital share of his military retired pay. He was still on active duty at that point in time. He continued to work for approximately 10 more years. The time of the final decree was entered on July 12, 2006. The parties executed and the judge entered in the trial court a benefit assignment order. It was an agreed benefit assignment order which provided that the former spouse would receive 50% of the marital share of the husband's gross monthly retired annuity. And it provided a fraction for the marital share, which provided 140 months as the numerator. The number of months of creditable service was not yet known, and that was left as an X to be determined at a later date, times 50% of the gross annuity. So as time went on,
There's no contest with regard to the formula used to calculate the benefit, is there?
No, sir. The formula was 50% of the gross. So what we're here about is, can the parties agree to use the gross? I believe that the...
Isn't the problem in this case figuring out what the gross is?
Well, no. From our perspective, the gross is the gross. The judge ruled that she's only entitled to 50% of the gross of what he would have received had he retired without a disability. Mm-hmm. And what we said all along is the gentleman receives two sources of income from the government. One is from the Veterans Administration. That's his disability pay.
And one from DFAS.
DFAS is his retired pay. Mm-hmm. And if you look on the monthly retiree account statements, he received a little over $3,100. That was the gross, and that's what we believe she's entitled to, 50% of that number, the marital share of that number. And so what we have is...
But wasn't the problem from the trial court's perspective, as far as I was able to discern, is figuring out what numbers to use because there was a limitation as to how much money he had received as part of his disability pay and how much money he had received as part of his regular retirement pay, and figuring out exactly what that number was?
Well, I think that's where the court erred, because the court was confused as to the significance of the waiver that the Veterans Administration required to give him his disability component. The court seemed to think that his retired pay was somehow transformed into a disability component. He had two disability pays, one from the Veterans Administration and one from DFS, the retired pay. They tried to label the DFS retired pay disability, and the court rightfully found that you can't say he has no retired pay, then this woman would receive nothing. That's not what the parties intended.
And
the
counsel, court, if I may interrupt you, it seems that Judge Bell has certainly struggled to try to come up with the formula here, but time and time again, I noticed throughout the transcript that he is asking both you and also Mr. Lamb's counsel, you know, give me some experts, help me out, you know, give me some information. Where are the exhibits? Where's the evidence that supports your claim?
The evidence are in the retiree account statements.
Well, were those, sir, were those retiree account statements ever admitted into evidence?
Yes, ma'am. They were admitted by Mr. Lamb himself, his counsel at the original hearing on May.
And how were they admitted? If you can help me with that, please.
Yes, ma'am.
Was that maybe in the packet that he handed up?
Is that it was in the packet that was handed up by Ms. Goldenberg, who was counsel for Mr. Lamb, and I believe it was their exhibit one or two, which provided, I had a similar set of exhibits, and because she introduced those, I didn't offer mine into evidence. They were already admitted by her, and they provided retiree account statements beginning, I believe, it was either June 2013 or July 1, 2013 was the first one.
Well, counsel, I noticed that there was the packet, and certainly we've all gone through that packet. The problem that I seem to notice, and I'm sure maybe I'm looking at it wrong, but I didn't see that packet was ever admitted into evidence. I agree that it was offered up, but I didn't see it admitted and marked.
Well, there was certainly a lot of confusion with this file. The file was in a state of disarray. I had to seek to compel that court to present to this court the file, if you'd like, I can find.
Well, I don't want you to spend all your time doing that, counsel. I just thought maybe you could point me to it. I might have missed it.
Those, I am clear that those, if you look at the appendix at page 277, these are the retiree account statements that were offered by Ms. Goldenberg and were received. And I didn't realize that that was an issue, but it was certainly discussed by Judge Bellows, and he said to Ms. Goldenberg, these say on here retiree account statements.
But I guess the point that Judge Chafin is making, and I share the concern, is that while something may be an exhibit, it needs to be in evidence to be considered. And I think she's suggesting, and I think we have the same problem, is that the exhibit is not part of the record as offered into evidence as far as we can tell. And if you could point to us somewhere where Judge Bellows says, I admit these particular documents into evidence, it probably will alleviate the concern that both of us are raising.
Yes, let me take a quick look for that, Your Honor. I'm looking at page 84 of the appendix. I believe it's Ms. Goldenberg talking in the line 17, or 15 through 17. We'd introduce into evidence or ask the court to receive consideration all documents under tab 2. I believe at that point is where she's offered in the DFAS retiree account statements.
And does the judge say admitted or marked or anything like that? Don't spend any more of your time.
Well, this trial judge, from the very beginning, Your Honors, was not conducted in what we would consider a call a witness, direct examination, cross-examination. The judge determined an opening statement. This is a pure legal issue. I don't really need to read anything but the contracts, and if I find them ambiguous, then we'll take evidence. And so throughout the proceeding, no one knew if we were giving opening statements, if we were arguing, if there was going to be evidence submitted. So I think when she offered that from my perspective, and I think when I got the record from the trial court, those were part of the record.
Basically, then you would suggest that it was a proffer that you did not object to.
Absolutely.
At a minimum.
I think everyone considered these were his retiree account statements. That was never an issue. That we knew he was getting $3,100 and some change as his gross military retired pay. That's not been an issue. But what I'd like to indicate to the court is this. Back in 1981, the U.S. Supreme Court decided the McCarty versus McCarty case, 453 U.S. 210. And back then, they considered military retired pay to be personal to the member only. Spouses really didn't have any interest in those. So the very next year, Congress enacted a Uniform Services Former Spouse Protection Act. 10 U.S.C.A. 1408. The act specifically granted state courts the authority to divide military retired pay during divorce. But it indicated in a subsequent case, Manzel versus Manzel, 490 U.S. 581, that did not apply to veterans' disability pay. So, subsequent, this court began to look at how these federal laws might apply in the divorce context. And there was a case decided by this court, Lambert versus Lambert, 10 Virginia App 623. Now, that case was an equitable distribution case. The court heard all the evidence. There was no agreement.
And I think from my perspective that you're on very firm footing from the standpoint that your client is entitled to something. Let's not call it anything, but something as it relates to her former husband's military service. I think we all can agree on that. And the reason why is because of the way that it was denoted. It wasn't denoted as her receiving his disability pay, but rather it was denoted as her receiving some portion of the benefits that he receives from his military pay, or military service, I think is a better word.
The Owen case that I cited in my brief, Owen v. Owen, 14 Virginia App 623, Your Honors. In that case, those parties agreed that the former spouse would receive 50% of the gross military retired pay based upon 25 years. They were married in 1963, separated in 87. His employment continued. So by them specifying 25 years, they've essentially defined that as the marital share. That was 25 years. So in our case, they were married 11 years. They knew that was the marital share. There's really no distinction between Owen and our case. And in that case, Judge Duff found that it does not violate federal law for the parties to enter into an agreement. Parties can agree to what they want to agree to, and they agreed that it would be 50% of the gross based upon 25 years.
Based upon your calculation, what is the difference in the amount of money that she would receive if your formula was adopted and the amount of money that she received based upon Judge Bello's calculation?
My calculation appears on page 8 of my brief. Based upon the initial gross, at some point he got a COLA increase. After she pays the SBP cost of 203.43, her total per month will be $681.91. If you take the calculation, which was a pure proffer by opposing counsel, there was no evidence to support this calculation. She said his last 3 years were his high 3 years. There was no evidence before the court to show what the three high years were. But I'm sorry, to get to your question, Your Honor. On page 388 of the appendix, after the survivor annuity premium, it's $380.16. So we're talking
$291.
Yeah. But you know, this is this can add up over time. And the thing about it is, and I argue this to Judge Bellows, if you take a look at page SBP monthly premium, and you multiply the gross monthly retirement amount by a fraction. And so in this case, it came out to almost exactly $203.43 when you multiply that fraction by the $3,124 per month. And so they were harping that, you know, she hasn't paid her monthly, the amount for the survivor annuity premium. She's never paid that. And he said he would take care of that. It would all be worked out in the math. But my point is, she shouldn't have to pay the monthly annuity premium based upon the gross $3,124 if she's not getting the corresponding.
So in other words, in your view, it's mixing apples and oranges. It's using one number as it relates to the regular retirement benefit, and using that same number as it relates to the disability benefit. And so if we're going to call it one thing, we should call it the one thing throughout.
That was my argument on that particular point.
Well, your time has expired, but we'll give you another minute to sum up because we had you dig in a little bit.
Yes, Your Honor. And one other point that they tried to raise is the Owen case required some indemnification. And this court decided McClellan versus McClellan. It was 33 Virginia Ave 376. We do not read Owen to require an indemnity agreement. It's my position, by using the gross, that the parties in essence built in their own indemnity. He can't reduce this by taking a waiver. The gross is the gross, and they've pretty much prohibited him from doing anything to reduce that amount. And so, you know, for lack of better closing, the gross is the gross, and this is what they've agreed to. It's a simple formula, and I see no reason why these parties can't agree to it. They did agree to it, and to try and come up with some other formula, it's like throwing a dartboard at a calculator. We have no way of determining what he would have received. This is what he did receive.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Appreciate your presentation.
Thank you.
We're administering this docket a little bit different than